listening to KSCO Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me.
Orly Lobel is my guest. She's a brilliant law professor and the author of several books, but her latest is called You Don't Own Me, How Mattel versus MGA Entertainment Exposed Barbie's Dark Side. Orly Lobel, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, I wanted to read your book because I love toys and I'm a fan and I'm a collector of Barbie, but reading You Don't Own Me is like having someone who loves hot dogs find out what's in hot dogs.
Yeah, I would love to see your collection at some point.
Mattel, it's a monster.
Yeah, it is a huge corporation. It's a lot of different things. It's been around for 6 decades, and there are dark sides to Barbie and to its inventor, its past, and its current corporate culture.
Yeah, so this is the story of this guy who was working at Mattel, and he came up with an idea that I think Mattel would never in a million years want to do anything with. And so he took it to a rival company. That was Bratz, was the idea. And then Bratz got sued by Mattel, essentially, right?
Exactly. So the doll Barbie, we all know, has been dominating the toy market, the doll market, for many years, and a former Mattel employee comes up with an idea of a bratty doll that's Bratz, as you say, very different, sassy, multi-ethnic, unlike the clean, white, all-American, good girl Barbie. And he sells, Carter Bryant, this inventor of Bratz, sells the idea to a competitor company, MGA. It becomes an overnight success. Bratz. Suddenly, Barbie is knocked off her pedestal in the toy stores. The toy shelves are full of Bratz. Girls want to buy Bratz in the holiday season. And Mattel, only after Bratz's success and release, finds out that Carter Bryant, their former employee, was behind this creative idea.
How did they find that out? That was a key piece of information that they needed, I guess.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's sometimes in these battles, the enemy of your enemy is your friend. So they get an anonymous letter from Hong Kong, and it turns out it's attorneys for a small company in China that's allegedly infringing upon Bratz trademark and copyright. And so when MGA sues that Chinese company, the Hong Kong attorneys dig in, and they actually figure out that maybe Mattel has a claim over this doll line because it's a former employee of theirs. So they send it, again, a year after the MGA releases Bratz, and it's a huge success, they send an anonymous letter to the Mattel Corporation headquarters, and that triggers all the decade-long courtroom drama that comes out of that.
Which you describe so well in this book, You Don't Own Me. And it's a great book. I really loved it, and it's so layered and crazy. But when my first instinct as I was reading it was that this guy who was working for Mattel, Carter Bryant, so he was working for Mattel, and according to their contract, which seems like a crazy contract, but it was one that he signed, any idea that he has while he's working for Mattel is their idea. And although he definitely made the deal with MGA before he officially quit working at Mattel, right?
That's right. Yeah, they were sneaking around and meeting in parking lots. And yeah, he had some sense that Mattel was the dominant player in the toy industry here in Southern California, but really the world's largest toy company and almost a monopoly. Really, the toy industry is really concentrated. So basically a duopoly between Mattel and Hasbro at the time. And he, as you say, had signed this draconian contract that Mattel uniformly gives its creative employees, its designers, its executives, anybody who works for Mattel signs this assignment agreement, pre-innovation assignment agreement, that anything that you come up with is owned by Mattel. This, by the way, is not unique to the toy industry. And a lot of my research and my previous book, Talent Wants to Be Free, has been about how we all are signing away a lot of our talents and skills and experience and professional networks and just mobility, ability to compete with our former employers by signing these contracts when we, you know, employment contracts when we accept an initial offer from a company. So, yeah, he's bound by this contract, but he's also really disappointed and disillusioned by the corporation that he works for because he feels like they're not developing any new ideas. Barbie is just the one toy, the one doll that they're marketing, and he wants to do something different.
And they have absolutely no interest in doing anything different, and why would they? Because they're selling thousands of billions of Barbies. Didn't you say that if you took Barbie end to end, it would go around the world like 70 times or something?
Yeah, that's a statistic that I think Mattel is proud of, and they have all kinds of statistics about how every American girl owns, on average, 9 Barbies, and around the world, like 90% of girls around the world own a Barbie. So they're worldwide dominating the doll industry, and the incentives are very low to innovate. And that's, again, that's something that's specific to this story, but also a universal fact about concentrated markets, that if you are too big, too dominating, too dominant in the industry, your incentives are vastly lower to innovate and to put out new products. In fact, Mattel has this term that they use internally about not wanting to cannibalize Barbie. Like, you know, we don't want somebody else, another icon, another doll, to take away her market share.
There's so much in what you've already said, and in this book, in addition to this case between Bratz versus Barbie, and I think they should have just had them fight it out in the ring. That would have been good. But you know, when I was a kid and I first saw Barbie, I said, "This is a toy for girls," you know, because it appealed to me. And there's that whole physical aspect of Barbie that you get into in your book about, you know, how it does sort of foster a bad self-image in girls who play with Barbie because they'll never ever look like Barbie, and then they end up cutting Barbie's hair or burning their head off or dismember Barbie in some ways. Like, part of the ritual of owning Barbies is then destroying them.
Yeah, this story really allowed me to go into the consumer psychology and the amazing marketing efforts and strategies that Mattel from the beginning put in to Barbie and to creating her persona. And that's why the case that later came about, the courtroom drama that I describe that went on for a decade now in recent years, is really interesting in that kind of historical perspective, because Barbie herself has a dark side, started with a dark side. She has a secret history. She actually is not the all-American girl that Mattel wants her to seem. She comes to us from a German doppelganger. Basically, she is kind of taken from the old world, from Europe, by the founder of Mattel. She, in Germany, was a cartoon and then an adult toy, not marketed for girls, as you say. You know, her appeal was her sex appeal. And
have you seen one of the? It was Lily, was her name, right?
Yes, Build Lily.
Right. Have you seen a Lily? I mean, what do they still exist? And
yeah, you can get them on Etsy and eBay. They're worth quite a bit because they're collector items. Really, the initial Barbie that was put out in the 50s was the spitting image of the German doll that they had brought from Germany, from Europe, and all they did really was file her nipples and change a little bit of the size of her lips and shape of her eyes, and then mass-produced her. And there was a lot of psychology going into how are we going to convince mothers to buy this doll for our little girls rather than, you know, men buying them for their girlfriends or vice versa.
Well, now I remember Barbie when, you know, Barbie, you're beautiful. You make me feel my Barbie doll is really real. And Barbie, she had a pouty kind of a face. She wasn't smiling like the Barbies today. And she wouldn't look at you. She was looking somewhere else. Was Lily looking somewhere else also?
Yeah, it was sort of not that kind of bold, more empowered look that changed over time within the Mattel design. So that was actually part of her transformation over the decades, that she now looks straight at you, is more of a career woman. There have been sort of a lot of steps along the way in thinking about what consumer taste is about. So another thing about Barbie, of course, is that she's always been white, blonde, again, all-American, but Mattel keeps going one step forward and then oftentimes two steps back and making her more multi-ethnic, introducing an African-American Barbie.
I remember the African-American Barbie, and I can't remember what her name was, Stacy or Kendra or something. And she was just Barbie that had been, you know, made with brown plastic instead of whatever the other color plastic is.
Right. They just pour a different shade of plastic into the same mold, which was part of the critical race critique against that kind of development. And that was also something that was very different about Bratz, because Bratz was immediately introduced into the market as a group of girls that were not even multi-ethnic in the sense of here's the African-American doll, here's the white doll, here's the Asian doll, but they were more mixed. You know, you couldn't really pigeonhole them in that way, and that it was more reflective, is more reflective of what we look like today and how we are, how we interact.
When Bratz, and they came in 2000, right? That was when we first saw Bratz.
Yeah.
And I saw them at the Target or something, and I said, oh, look, they have a little line of streetwalkers now.
Right. Yeah, so it's really interesting because, again, Build Lily was described as a streetwalker. That's the origins of Barbie. Then Barbie has a very ambivalent relationship to her own sexuality. She has held every single career possible, but she's never become a woman. She's never become a mother. That was a Freudian slip on my part, maybe. But it isn't completely a Freudian slip, because the kind of question that feminists have raised is whether she has never become... She's deliberately never held this position of a mom. She is only like a babysitter sometimes, a nanny.
She has a kid sister, if I recall.
Right, right. But the play on this is that she, on the one hand, wants to continue her kind of sex appeal and never age, but also her virginal appearance. Her nipples were filed, and she has no, just like Ken, they have no kind of realistic, you know, genitals, and there's that, I think, impulse within the Mattel Corporation to keep her seemingly clean and virginal. That's also been the source of a lot of litigation, apart from the Bratz case. So Mattel has been going after a lot of different challengers, competitors like MGA that produced Bratz, but also Mattel oftentimes sues artists and songwriters, musicians, film producers. So you just sang one song, and maybe you want to sing the
I'm a Barbie girl. It's fantastic.
Life in plastic, right? So that was another lawsuit. So that's a Danish band, Aqua, and they have this hit pop song. And Mattel immediately sues them for infringing the Mattel intellectual property rights by even saying the word Barbie, because there were no images of Barbie used. And that's part of the story of control, of trying to control the culture of Barbie, the image of Barbie that unfolds in my book, And You Don't Own Me, of how you have this cultural icon and the both rational and extremely irrational impulses and behaviors and actions that the executives within this conglomerate take to maintain their dominance and their control over the image.
Well, it seems impossible to copyright the name Barbie, because Barbie was a name before Barbie. When the Marx Brothers in 1946 or something made a movie called A Night in Casablanca, and Warner Brothers tried to get them not to do it because they had made a movie called Casablanca, and they said they were infringing on their copyright. And Groucho replied, "Well, we were the Marx Brothers before you were the Warner Brothers, so he would sue them right back." And that was the last they heard about that particular lawsuit. But copyright law, it seems to me, you know, was designed to ensure creativity, to allow people to profit from their creativity. But copyright law, as you describe it and You Don't Own Me, it's like harnessing and stopping all creativity.
Yeah, so that's exactly the puzzle that's really the key question and analysis that comes out of this book and a lot of my research, is whether we're not being counterproductive and really perversing the whole point of intellectual property, exactly what you describe with copyright, also patent law and trademark law, trade secrecy, all of those pillars of intellectual property. They are originally on the books. They've been adopted by Congress to promote progress in arts and sciences, and that's even in our Constitution, promote progress in arts and science. And a lot of times, and you see this in You Don't Own Me, in the Mattel versus MGA case, and in Mattel's lawsuits at large against any parody of Barbie, any challenger of Barbie, but you see this in so many different industries. You see this with Disney going after, you know, any smaller competitor or artist that tries to do some cartoon of Mickey Mouse or do a different kind of Cinderella. When you have the dominant position and you have the power to launch lawsuits, even if some of them are frivolous and completely without merit, you are going to use the law as a sledgehammer, and that has a hugely chilling effect on what we choose to do as people, as individuals in these creative industries.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and we're talking with law professor Orlie Lobel. Her new book is called You Don't Own Me, How Mattel versus MGA Entertainment Exposed Barbie's Dark Side. Orlie Lobel, in your book, You Don't Own Me, you mentioned Jack Kirby, and I was also thinking of Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster. They were comic book artists who created some of the most popular comic book characters on Earth. So those were comic book artists who, when they signed their checks, they signed away the rights to the art that they drew, and which included the characters that they created. I was at the grocery store the other day, right after having read your book, and I saw this Marvel Comics Digest that was filled with Jack Kirby artwork and characters that he created, that they're still marketing after his death, and he's not profiting, his family isn't profiting.
Yeah, so, and that's a other aspect of it. So it's not only that copyright law is used as a sword to not allow others to remix and build upon, you know, the art and culture that we love, which is really the history of art in general. This is what we do as musicians. We pay homage to former, you know, beloved musicians. As artists, we build upon the building blocks of, you know, previous generations, previous schools of thought of art, and the law is used in this kind of way of saying, okay, no more. Now we're stopping, and this is mine. This is the fence. But it's also the fact that a lot of the profits and that ownership is not in the hands of those who actually have created the art. So there's that disconnect. It's a disconnect of ownership and disconnect of the incentive structure. So the people who are the creatives oftentimes don't see a lot of the benefits and the profits from, you know, what these blockbusters like, you know, whatever Disney has or Marvel or Pixar. If, you know, you choose publishers, there's a very small share goes to the artist. Same with science and technology these days. It's really 90% of patents really go to corporations and not to independent inventors. And that's something that the policy has to grapple with, that there's kind of that loss of the individual and the lone inventor. You know, we have this romantic idea of somebody sitting in her garage or the attic and coming up with eureka moments, and that's not the reality these days. The reality is that big corporations hold so much of the knowledge, the intellectual property rights to what we've, you know, created as a society.
So even when the courts want to side with an artist, they are held by what the legality of these copyright laws and contracts say.
In general, yes, but there's a lot of play there. So that's what was really fascinating for me in the You Don't Own Me story and the courtroom drama, and kind of it's a legal thriller. I love when readers tell me that it reads like a legal thriller novel, even though it's nonfiction. You know, I did all this archival work, and I talked to so many of the players on both sides, the executives and the jurors and the judges. What was fascinating was to see how much the personality, the mindset, and, you know, the way that you understand what actually happened will affect the outcome of the cases. And that's why it's a roller coaster case. I don't want to provide any spoilers in the end, but there's not a clear answer of who really owned Bratz in the end. Do we enforce these really draconian contracts? We don't have to. A juror and a judge have to interpret with an understanding of what we're actually doing, what we're trying to achieve, what is the purpose of our doctrine, of our contract law, of our intellectual property law. And so there is room to understand the actual effects, the questions of justice that are at the basis of these battles and debates, and I think that, you know, we can get it better than we often do.
Well, the average Toys R Us shopper or whatever, they go into the store and they see the toys and they buy them, or their kids make them buy them, or they whatever. And I don't think most people are even aware that any of this stuff was going on, unless they happened to see it in the newspaper or they were following it. So how did you stumble upon this case?
Yeah, well, so I have a few different answers on, you know, how did I become a critic of the toy industry. The easy answer is that I'm a law professor and my research is in the field of intellectual property and employment law at the intersections of contract and statutes, and I knew about this case. I knew the attorneys that are litigating this case, and in my previous book, Talent Wants to Be Free, which had quite a big impact on, with these arguments that I developed in my research, I was invited to the White House in 2016 to speak about Talent Wants to Be Free and about drawing the right lines between talent mobility and knowledge fencing. So I was really intrigued by this case, and I wanted to bring to the public, as you say, you know, much more awareness of these industries, the toy and entertainment industries, how they have the same ruthlessness and ethical questions that we know about a little bit more when we think about the financial industries and Silicon Valley and tech industry, but we don't have so much of insight when we think about, you know, what's happening in these cultural icon developments.
And we think of toys as being this marvelous thing. Oh, we're making a toy because we want children to smile and have a good time. But they're much more like the cigarette industry, with the tobacco industry, with their research and the way they've they know what they're doing.
Absolutely. So right. And so beyond that short answer of yes, I'm a law professor and I research these cases across different industries. I think you're absolutely right to link the tobacco and toy industries because there is that link that I actually uncover at a later point in the book. I go back to the history, the secret history of the marketing, the transformation of Barbie, and I uncover this marketing guru who was really a psychologist. He was an Austrian psychology-trained PhD who brought to the United States this insight that we can do consumer marketing using Freudian psychology and ideas about addiction and using insecurities and using what I would call a lot of misleading and false advertisement to get people hooked, be it toys or tobacco. And in fact, the same guy, Ernest Dietcher, who was really so important to Mattel and making Barbie so dominant, was also behind a lot of the tobacco ads in that time in the 60s.
Not surprisingly. And, you know, the thing about Barbie that made sense, I think, from a marketing point of view, when it first arrived in 1959, I think it was, is that you could get Barbie for 98 cents, but her clothes... She came basically wearing a swimsuit, but her clothes cost $3.98, and there was dozens and dozens and dozens of different kinds of clothes. So it was like, buy this vehicle, and then you can have it real cheap, but the next one is going to cost you. They were like pushers. They were
exactly. So that's another innovation that started with Mattel and the toy industry and was really something that we see across the board and part of our consumer culture these days of merchandising, of getting you hooked on one item, but then you keep paying the membership, the premium. These are all business models that start with, you know, having to buy the next fashion item for Barbie and then the cross-licensing, the how these cultural icons like Barbie and like the Marvel heroes and you know, some of our other beloved Disney characters, they really, the brand is what gives you the value. So you have films and you have the toys and you have all the school items and toothbrushes and, you know, backpacks and clothes. So that was part of the genius of becoming all about the intellectual property. If you think about it, that means that intellectual property, the ownership over the images, is really the greatest value that they're producing here, because it's not, you know, they're not really making anything. They're manufacturing in China, and everybody can manufacture really cheap. It's really developing and policing the images that they've marketed, that they've, you know, put into the hearts and minds of young consumers.
And litigating their enemies into the ground.
Yes. Yeah. And I'll just to kind of close the circle on, you know, what led me to write this particular story, which, you know, beyond the fact that it's so fascinating and thrilling to look at this particular case of MGA and Mattel, because it was tried twice and it had two different sets of attorneys, two different teams of judges and different jurors and executives, and you see how personality and storytelling is so important in the courtroom. But beyond that, really, when I look back at my own development, I reveal in the book that I became a really early critic of the toy industry when my own mother, who's a psychology professor and does experimental psychology studies on gender development in children, she posed me at a very early age in a series of videos where in some videos I'm playing with boy toys, what we think of as, you know, male toys, in the blue shelf of having trucks and baseballs and soccer balls. And in another set of videos, I'm playing with the toy shelf, the pink shelf, the Barbies and tiaras and makeup. And she ran these studies all over the world where she asked the subjects of her study, the viewers, to say something about how they perceived me, you know, this child actress for experimental psychology, and to kind of assess my different qualities, different characteristics of mine. And it was very, very strong, her findings, again, all over the world, where when I was playing with the pink toys, the Barbies, I was perceived as less intelligent, less possessing leadership skills, less likely to succeed. So for me, it was, I think, a real kind of early message and signaling that play is great. We, you know, I love playing, and now I have daughters of my own, and I really, in the book, I also did a lot of research on that, the value of play. But we also have to take play seriously and understand that it's important, you know, that there's an impact, and the choices that we make as parents and as people, you know, as kids, really matters in our identity and our development, our social interaction.
So when your little girls wanted to play with Barbie, did you get them some machine guns to play with instead?
So my daughters are, they don't play with Barbie, but I don't think I've ever, you know, kind of prevented it from them. I didn't never bought them Barbies, but inevitably, they got some for their birthdays from friends. I'm sure they got some messages from us, not kind of directly, but my husband, who only has daughters, is an F-16 pilot. We actually both were in the military before both becoming professors, and I think we just have a different taste of what we like to do than, you know, playing with dolls. So we're very active, and we buy them Lego, and we're very into kind of training them in the world of STEM.
You know, even Legos, Legos used to be a thing. When I was a kid, a Lego was just a random bunch of blocks in different colors, and you could just assemble them and however. But now a Lego is like a puzzle that you're supposed to get that exact kind of rocket ship or something. They're not quite the same, Legos.
Yeah, and I actually, toward the end of the book, I have a little bit of a kind of a window to Lego and other toys, and I think you're absolutely right that we've seen kind of a narrowing of the choices that kids have when they buy toys. It's much more spoon-fed and much more directed, more basically less creative and kind of free. And with Lego, too, there's been a big feminist critique about why did Lego have to introduce what they call their Friends series, which is the Pink Shelf Lego, which is kind of flowery, you know, if a girl wants to play with Lego, here's the box that you should buy. It's maybe like a mermaid, you know, or buying a, or building a, like, princess castle or whatever it is, rather than the more, you know, building ships and architecture and all that, which is the more generic but also marketed more to boys.
I'm Gary Shapiro, back with more From the Bookshelf here on KSCO. My guest tonight is Orly Lobel, and her new book is called You Don't Own Me, How Mattel versus MGA Entertainment Exposed Barbie's Dark Side. And now Barbie has this, as you write about in your book, this fashionistas brand where they have, and I don't know how to describe it, fat Barbie, I guess would be the word.
Yeah, so body image, and we didn't even talk about that. It's been so much fun for me to write this book that is in some way about law and litigation and intellectual property, and a lot of the reviewers have, I've really loved reading kind of how they say that you learn a lot from the book, but you don't feel it, like you don't notice it. It's like, you know, things that are healthy for you, but they're like,
it's a painless and, like, learning experience. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. but because it's about Barbie, it really opens windows to these questions about images of womanhood and body image. And you can see, again, that Barbie only changes when there is more external challenge of the brand from competitors. And that's why...
Not from the public, right? It had nothing to do
with...
Some
of it sometimes is from the public, but most reactions, the recent changes that have been the most dramatic have really been because there was the Bratz competition that had more realistic body images. You know, after decades of not introducing anything but the one impossibly perfect, unrealistic body that Barbie possessed from the beginning. So mostly it's when a brand really feels threatened in terms of bottom line profit and competition. That's kind of a simple economic intuition that economists have, that, you know, you don't really have a lot of incentive to change when you're the dominant player, and when there's external pressures, that's when we see change. And that's why so much for me, the study of our law and policy is about wanting to ensure that there is new entry and there is competition and there is consumer choice.
Oh, okay, so I was looking at the plus size Barbie, and it struck me that it's not a very interesting looking doll. And when we talk about superheroes and Wonder Woman and Superman, I mean, yeah, Wonder Woman has gigantic breasts, but also Superman has gigantic pecs. I mean, the idea of superheroes is that they're idealized versions of people. And I guess that's what a doll does too. I mean, you know, those baby dolls that look like super real, those are like creepy.
Yeah, there's a whole field of psychology research about how people have these creepy or creeped out reactions. It's called an uncanny valley, when an inanimate object looks too human, too real, and too much like us. So that's interesting. That's going to be coming a lot in the next few years, when
robots and all that.
Robots and definitely sex robots, you know, sex bots that are now in all of the conferences and, you know, design fairs. They're coming to the public. So that's an interesting question that you ask here, that should we kind of accept that that's just the reality, that superheroes are going to be unrealistically perfect, so why not a fashion doll, idealized? And I think that's problematic because the message of Barbie and the idea of marketing her to young girls, it was the first time when Mattel introduced her in the 50s, it was the first time that parents, and particularly mothers, were basically messaged and told to buy this fashion doll for their daughters to play with, as opposed to just baby dolls. So, you know, it used to be that that's what little girls would play with, the little babies they would cradle and kind of practice to become mothers.
Whereas this is practicing to become a fashion model, a very skinny fashion model.
That's right. So this is practicing the message in all of the Mattel ads, and I'm wondering if you can come up with other ads to sing, but the message has always been, you can be everything, this is what you can be, and this is personifying you, the girl who's playing with Barbie. You can imagine yourself in her. And actually Ruth Handler, the founder of Mattel, and you know, she claimed to have invented Barbie, even though she kind of snapped her away from Europe and brought her to the headquarters and they mass-produced her.
Stole her, I think, is the word you're avoiding.
Yeah, there was a lawsuit at the inception, too. But she even explained that, you know, because this is for girls to imagine themselves as, this is why she gave her great breasts, because that's what girls wanted to have later on, and, you know, she would definitely not want her to be flat-chested. But then, if you have such an unrealistic, I mean, there's all these studies. There's a Finnish study that looked at what Barbie would be if she was a real woman, and she would definitely tip over. She just wouldn't be able to hold herself. She wouldn't have the intestines, the internal organs that we have. She just, the waist is unbelievably small. She wouldn't be able to bear children, and she never has. That's the one thing that she's never done. And
her feet, you know, she has to wear high heels because her feet are bent.
Right. Yeah. So that's it. There's been so much feminist critique of.
They're not coming out. Don't they have Bunyan Barbie coming out now? Or no, I'm just kidding.
Right. And it's interesting because I think we all have this ambivalence within us because we want to as feminists, as you know, somebody who is a woman and. I have a career and I have daughters. I see this kind of tension where I want women to be able to dream of, you know, being whatever they want to be and dress however they want to dress and be sexy and sexual, and, you know, that's we want the whole spectrum, but we also want choices, and we want realistic ideas about what our bodies are like, and definitely when it has to do with the minds of young girls. There's been a lot of this culture at Mattel of just missteps in marketing her. Like, one of the products came with like Barbie slumber party, and there was a scale where they would the little dolls would weigh themselves. And the scale would show, would just be stuck on, like, an anorexic
88 pounds
weight. Yeah. And then there's been these, like, Barbie diet books that, again, Mattel produced. And first rule, don't eat. So, you know, I never say in the book, and I don't believe that Mattel is sort of the source of all evils of body image problems, feminist, you know, or misogynist, anti-feminist, you know, images of womanhood. It's more like Barbie is sort of a reflection and then an acceleration of a lot of our insecurities and problems and tensions that exist, you know, in our society in general. So it's really fascinating to see how that plays out in a corporate culture and in corporate wars that are launched in the courtroom.
It's amazing how much you put into 250 pages. The book is called You Don't Own Me, How Mattel versus MGA Entertainment Exposed Barbie's Dark Side. And the author, the brilliant Orly Lobel, thank you so much for spending some time talking to us on From the Bookshelf.
Thank you. I had a lot of fun.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program. Come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at FromTheBookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts, and you can like us on Facebook. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas and Ollie Jackson. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.